It's Central Time. I'm Darrell Connor. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk with a higher education expert who says we need to consider the danger of pricing middle-class families out of college. We'll learn what's at stake in just a bit. But first, the Electoral College is one of the longest-standing institutions in American politics, but it's become one of the most controversial as well. Presidential elections in 2000 and 2016 saw candidates win a majority of electoral votes while losing the popular vote. That's led many people to say we should get rid of the Electoral College, but the prospect of making that happen is slim. Our next guest says that looking back to the original vision of the Electoral College can give us some direction. He says that today it isn't doing what our founders hoped it would, and there are changes both parties could support to get it back on track. Edward Foley is a professor of law at The Ohio State University and author of the book Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. Ned, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for spending some time with us. We really appreciate it. Now, Ned, you've gone back and way back in the day and dug into the debates our founders had in this country's early years and how they thought the president should be elected. So it sounds like most were committed to the idea of majority rule, but they didn't want to rely on a simple popular vote. So what were they hoping to achieve?
Well, that's exactly right. Given the fact that it's the United States, this collection of states, and they believed in that federalism principle, that it was a union of states, they had a kind of a majority rule for this united country, which they considered was a compound majority. So it was a two-stage process. The candidates were supposed to get majority support within states and within enough states so that in the aggregate they could have the appropriate federal majority. So it wasn't just a simple, let's have all the voters all across America raise their hand. It was, let's go state by state and create majorities at the state level and aggregate that into a federal majority.
Now, there were a lot of intense debates, and you talked about that a little bit, about this issue before it got settled. But what were some of the competing ideas about how we should elect the president?
Sure, and we actually did a transformation, and this is what I think most people don't realize, because, again, it was a long, long time ago, and we weren't around back then.
Right.
So at the beginning, you know, we had our original Constitution that was the product of the convention in Philadelphia in 1787. And they had a vision then that they hoped would achieve consensus. They had in mind George Washington as the perfect president, and he became the first president, and they thought he would rise above factions. Remember, they didn't want to have political parties. It's so hard to imagine that now, but they thought they could actually create a constitution that would avoid the development of the two-party system as we now have come to know it, and they thought they would just have a bunch of different interest groups, farmers and bankers and merchants, but they wouldn't coalesce into parties. And they hoped that a president of the whole nation could kind of rise above all those interest groups and be a consensus choice. So they built a kind of complicated model with that in mind. That was 1787. That almost immediately broke down after George Washington's two terms. Now, he fit the vision, and he was suitable for that. But then in his administration, even, two parties developed. And the founders who had been united about the Constitution, like Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, who jointly wrote the Federalist Papers together in support of the Constitution, they suddenly become intense political opponents, where you have one party with John Adams and Alexander Hamilton on one side, and you've got Thomas Jefferson and James Madison on the other side. So this idea that the founders all agreed on everything, no. And the partisanship became, believe it or not, almost as intense as it is now. And we think we have the red-blue divide now. Well, they had something similar back then as they went into the election of 1800 in particular, and that was Adams versus Jefferson. And it was intense. And the system kind of broke down for reasons we could get into if we wanted to. But the key point is that after that, the dust settled, and Jefferson became president in 1800, based on what his party thought was he was the right guy, because he was the person who did have majority support in enough states to get this federal majority. But he thought that it was going to be stolen from him by the Adams supporters. But once they consolidated their power, the Jeffersonians, and they did, he became very popular, partly for the Louisiana Purchase. So when he was looking ahead to his reelection in 1804, they redesigned the Electoral College and put it in what's the 12th Amendment to our Constitution. That's the Electoral College that governs us still today, not the 1787 version. They threw that out and replaced it. And now we have to think of Jefferson as the model president, not George Washington. They knew, his supporters knew, it wasn't going to be consensus and all kumbaya anymore, because they knew they were fighting Adams and Hamilton and the Federalists. And so they redesigned the system for what they thought was genuine majority rule, even if you couldn't have consensus. And that's the system that they put into place. And that was this. Jefferson was the right person, and he won re-election on this basis in 1804 because they got their amendment through, and he wins by accumulating the majority support of the states that give him his Electoral College victory. So that was how the system was supposed to work, and then for other historical complicated reasons, we've kind of fallen away from that majority rule vision, and now we can have presidents, as you said at the outset, elected with only minority support, not majority support. And so that's not what they wanted when they wrote the 12th Amendment to give us majority rule.
Edward Foley is a professor of law at The Ohio State University and author of the book Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. And we are talking about how we can possibly fix the Electoral College system. Now, you talked about the 12th Amendment that was ratified in 1804, which gave us the modern form of the Electoral College. And as you spoke, Ned, you said it worked for a while, but near the middle of the century, it started to stray from that original vision. What are some of the things that happened?
Yeah, so what happens is that they leave in place this original provision that states can implement the system by choosing at the state level the method for appointing these electors, right, who are the members of the Electoral College. And when they wrote the 12th Amendment, they had in mind that states would choose among options, all of which would achieve majority rule at the state level, because that's all that they knew at the time. But they left in place this kind of Achilles heel, if you will, this vulnerability in the system that gave states the freedom to do whatever they wanted. And so then, as you say, along by the kind of middle of the 19th century, we get states abandoning at the state level the majority rule principle and allowing instead for candidates to get all of a state's electoral votes with only what's called a plurality of the popular vote. And your plurality is less than 50%. So if there's more than two candidates, you could have a three-way split, and somebody could get all of Wisconsin's electoral votes with only 40% of the popular vote in Wisconsin. That's contrary to the vision that they want, the Jeffersonians wanted for the 12th Amendment. That creeps into the system, you know, by the 1840s and 50s, this plurality system that allows for minority winners. But that's a deviation at the state level. So that's why, it's kind of latent. It's a defect that doesn't really affect the system unless you've got, you know, three-way splits. And for a long, long time, we didn't have too many of them. But as you said, Ralph Nader in 2000, Ross Perot in 1992, there are a couple of elections, particularly recent elections, where a third candidate can really make a difference because of this plurality system that creeps in. And so if we want to get back to the original vision of majority rule, states can undo the problem that crept in the middle of the 19th century by insisting at the state level on majority winners like they had before.
Edward Foley is a professor at law at The Ohio State University. He's also the author of the book Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. And we're talking about the original intent of the Electoral College and some ideas for change. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think there should be changes made to the Electoral College? If so, would you make adjustments or get rid of it altogether? Do you have questions for our guests about what the intent of the founders was or how potential changes to the system would work? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And we'll pick up this conversation in just a minute. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor. We're continuing our conversation about the Electoral College with Ned Foley. He is a professor of law at The Ohio State University and author of the book Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the Electoral College? If you think it needs to be reformed, what would you change? Do you think it's important that a candidate who gets a state's electoral votes actually wins the majority of its popular vote? What questions do you have for Ned about the Electoral College and its history? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, Ned, the Electoral College has gotten a lot of attention in more recent times thanks to the 2016 election as well as the election in 2000 and even before. How have things played out in those elections in terms of majority rule within the states? And let's start with 2016 first.
Sure. So everybody often talks about Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania as these, you know, three states that Trump unexpectedly won. But he didn't win a majority in those states. He got less than 50%. And that's because it wasn't just Hillary Clinton on the ballot. It wasn't just a two-way race. There was also Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, as well as others. And they factor. Now, I can't say for sure who would have won those states if it had just been a head-to-head competition. But the key point is at the state level, the rules allowed somebody to win without 50% and not only get some electoral votes from that state, but get all the marbles. That's the piece that the founders would have been so upset about. They contemplated the idea, and in fact some states did back then, where you'd divide a state's electoral votes if more than one candidate had significant support in the state. That was an option they considered, but they didn't want any one person to get all of the electoral votes if they were a minority candidate, minority meaning politically minority, less popular than the rest of the field. Sure. You shouldn't be able to get. So that was the objection. And yet that's what's in place, and that's what happened in 2016.
What about 2000?
Same thing, confined more to Florida. Ralph Nader affects that result. You know, it's Al Gore and George W. Bush. But Nader gets a significant amount of votes that affects what happens in Florida, and that, of course, affects what happens in the whole Electoral College. So same dynamic. 2016 is more widespread because it's actually six states where this same phenomenon, the big three of Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, but also Arizona, Florida again, and North Carolina, are all states that Trump won all the electoral votes of those states, amounting to 101 electoral votes. He needed them to win nationally, but he was under 50% there. The reason why both parties should be concerned about this is either major party can be affected by this dynamic depending upon the relationship of the extra candidates to the two main contenders. So that's why Ross Perot, many people think, affected George H.W. Bush in 1992, you know, hurting the Republicans, whereas Ralph Nader affects Al Gore, hurting the Democrats. But looking forward, this could affect either party, and again, detracts from the basic principle that you're not really a winner of the people of that state unless you have majority support in that state.
Ned Foley is with us. He's a professor of law at The Ohio State University and author of the book Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. And we're talking about the history of the Electoral College and whether the Electoral College needs some adjustments, or do we need to get rid of it altogether? Or should we do what the founders intended? Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Jeff in Superior. Good afternoon, Jeff. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi, I actually support the Electoral College for this reason. We live in a representative democracy, not a pure democracy. Therefore, when you look at the elections where the candidate got the most popular vote, the other candidate actually won a majority of the states. But I will agree that in a representative democracy, majority doesn't always rule. So I would support the idea of popular vote if they required a certain percentage of the population voting, and I think those voters should be U.S. citizens, not illegal aliens. Thank you.
Jeff, thanks so much for the call. What are your thoughts, Ned?
Yes, well, I think those are important points. In all 50 states right now, you are required to be a citizen to vote. And then the question is, how do we add up the votes of the eligible participants? And is there a threshold number that's necessary to win? The founders agreed with Jeff in the sense they didn't want just one monolithic, simple tally. They did believe in a representative system, but the question is, how do you structure the representative system? And they wanted representation based on the idea that if you have to choose between a majority and a minority, between 51% and 49%, the 51% should govern the 49% rather than the vice versa. And that's clear in the debates of the 12th Amendment. If you've gone back and read the debates, they say that over and over and over again because they don't want John Adams to win or other members of that party if they have only 49%. They want Jefferson to win, again, not at the national level, but building that coalition of states at the state level.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Frank in Madison. Good afternoon, Frank. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi, thank you very much. Listen, you don't have to abolish the Electoral College. There's a readily available solution. Increase the size of the House of Representatives. That would help, I think, fight gerrymandering to some extent. Term limits, I think, would go away because representatives would be much closer to the people they represent, and you would reduce the effect of money in elections because with an increased number of representatives running, those representatives would be fighting in smaller districts, and the effect of people in those districts, supporters in those districts, would outweigh the effect of the money of rich men, trying to flood the market with advertising for their favored lackeys.
Frank, thank you so much for the call. Ned, do you think adding more U.S. House of Representatives would help?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea for those reasons as well as others. But I also would caution folks to think about short-term reform and long-term reform and decide which reforms belong in which category. Because I think there are a lot of things, like getting rid of gerrymandering, a lot of things that should happen to improve American democracy. But one has to ask how realistic that is in what time frame. And if you're concerned about the 2020 presidential election and you want that to be fair for people of Wisconsin, people of other states, you have to say what's feasible between now and 2020. There's a window of opportunity, but it is closing. And so you have to say, is it more important to get some, maybe not best reform, but decent reform now? Or should you wait and strive for longer reform that might be more difficult to get? So I would put the changing the size of the House of Representatives into the long-term category. Definitely should be considered long, but I don't think that's realistic short-term. I think it is more realistic in pivotal states like Wisconsin to say, hey, are we comfortable with electing presidents based on minority rule, or do we believe that democracy means majority rule? And if that's achieved in critical states like Wisconsin, that could really make a difference for 2020.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Marcia in Grafton. Good afternoon, Marcia. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi. I don't know if I'm using the right terms, but I want to know what ranked voting is so that if you list your first, second, or third choice of candidates so that you could cross, I'm assuming you could cross parties. You could go Democrat or Independent or Green Party or whatever and list them in ranks, and that would prevent the catastrophe we're in right now.
Marcia, thank you so much for the call. Aren't there states that use ranked voting now?
Yes, Maine has just adopted it for congressional races. But Marsh is absolutely correct. That is, there's several different ways of achieving majority rule. And many people, including myself, think this ranked choice voting is actually probably the best. My point is that what our founders would have said is that any method that does majority rule is consistent with their vision. But this notion of ranked choice voting is consistent. One reason we know that is they actually used runoffs to achieve majority rule before they adopted the 12th Amendment, in Massachusetts and New Hampshire in particular. They didn't have the mechanism of a what we call instant runoff voting, which is another term for ranked choice voting, because they hadn't invented that yet. They had invented a two-stage runoff process. But insofar as ranked choice voting is a single-stage runoff process, the authors of the 12th Amendment would have said, hallelujah, you're doing exactly what we want you to do.
Weston emailed at ideas@wpr.org, said, I believe that the Electoral College is working reasonably well. The biggest problem facing the American people today is the two parties controlling our government. We need to find a way to break the grip of these two organizations who are more interested in maintaining power than what's good for the people. I would like to see changes made to the primary process and preference voting in elections. So with that said, with about a minute left, going forward, do you think we'll run into more of these controversial or seemingly undemocratic election results if we don't enact some type of change?
Yes. And the book that I'm working on now is showing that this new historical development means that what happened in 2016 is more likely to happen again because of current polarization and current disaffection with gridlock and the problems of government. So we're more likely to have what has happened this week, where you have somebody like Howard Schultz, the ex-Starbucks CEO, saying, hey, I want to get in the mix. So we're more likely to have a third party affecting the system. And in fact, if you want to open up the system so that we don't have just two parties, allowing a mechanism like ranked choice voting is the way to do it, because then it allows the existence of extra ideas to be in the system, but not mess the system up at the back end. The plurality system that we got in the middle of the 19th century is the worst system, because it kind of chokes off third parties and doesn't give them a real opportunity.
Ned, thanks so much for talking with us. Ned Foley is the chair in constitutional law at Ohio State University. He was with us to talk about ideas for electoral college reform that both major parties might be able to support. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up, lawmakers and advocacy groups on both sides of the political aisle are calling for changes to the state's expungement laws. We'll discuss the latest proposal, who's behind it, and why. But first, for many Americans, paying for college can seem as though it's getting further out of reach. And for many lower and middle income families, it is. Between rising tuition, room and board costs, books and other fees, it seems only America's wealthiest families can afford to foot the bill. And now, more than ever, students are finding that financial aid and scholarships don't defray the cost enough. Our next guest joins us to talk about what the long-term effects would be if middle-class families are priced out of college. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Sarah, you've talked about the new economics of college. Can you give us a summary of what that is?
Yeah, it's a whole new situation that people paying for college are facing. Not only are we at a time when college prices are at an all-time high, but we're also at a moment when families are struggling generally. You know, the rising price of college looks different when you're getting ahead from year to year. But when wages are stagnant and folks are worried about losing their homes, it's a different situation. It's also a different time where it's harder to get help. It used to be that if you needed to get food stamps, it was relatively straightforward to do so. And now we've got people who need them and can't get them. And then the other piece of this that really matters is that a lot of us do believe that working your way through college is a worthwhile thing to do. But it is harder than ever before to get a job that provides the hours and the schedule and the pay that you need so that you can work your way through school. So when you put all those things together, it really creates a perfect storm and shows you why the economics of college today is not the economics of yesterday.
So, Sarah, you've recently written about middle-class families being priced out of college. You wrote an article in the Biden Forum. Why did you want to look at this issue specifically?
You know, I wanted to write about it because I'm seeing it in the data that we've been collecting. For almost 20 years now, my team has been looking up close at what's happening to American college students, and we have started to really see that problems that historically seemed like they were only problems for what we call low-income students are now happening to middle-class families. And that's bearing out both in terms of what people are going through on their daily lives, but also what we can see in the data. So there's now new national data that shows us that, for example, when families do that FAFSA, you know, that horrible bureaucratic tragedy of a form, and they get through it, we can now see that middle-class families today have the results of a FAFSA and the price of college that looks like how poor families had it in 1990. So the data are telling us there's a problem, and yet when we talk about the price of college, we're acting like it's only affecting the poorest people.
Now, in your view, and you talked about the fact that it's affecting the middle class, so let's break this down a little bit. What happens if middle-class families get priced out of college altogether?
Well, I think there's two different kinds of things that can happen. I mean, one thing that middle-class families have that people in the working class don't necessarily have is prior college experience. So these folks, you know, they may already have experienced college and feel pretty bought in to the idea that, you know, their children are going to go. But where their children are going to go is going to change now. So when people are being priced out, for example, they may turn from sending their student to a place like, you know, UW-Whitewater and instead send them to one of the technical colleges. Now, that's not a bad thing. I am a big believer in the Wisconsin Technical College System and the UW colleges. But as we also know, sometimes it can, you know, be a longer route to get a degree, and sometimes people get deterred. But more importantly, it means that the preferences and choices made by many middle-class families may not be something that they can actually afford. On the upper end of the spectrum of the middle class, it may mean that, for example, you thought you were going to send your child to a private college, maybe an elite college of the kind that you see on television when people talk about what college is. And those named colleges are no longer affordable, and now you're going to have to send your student to a state school. Now, to be honest, I'm not going to really feel bad for you because it's still a really good education. But, again, it's going to leave people with a bad taste in their mouth. And I think these are the reasons, in many ways, why college has become the place that America loves to hate.
Sarah Goldrick-Rapp joins us. She is a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University, and we're talking about making college affordable for the middle class. Now, financial aid is available to students all across the board for the most part, but how is it falling short of middle-class families?
Well, I mean, the first thing is that financial aid is not nearly as available, actually, as a lot of colleges want you to believe. They'll tell you that, for example, they offer free tuition below a certain income, but not tell you that all of the other costs, the fees, the books, the supplies, the room, the board, all that other stuff is not covered. They will also restrict the aid to people who meet a certain income or, quote-unquote, need threshold. And those need thresholds are determined using some pretty bad data. So a family, for example, that makes, let's say, $200,000 a year, but who's underwater when it comes to their house and who has student debt and who's taking care of a parent who's in a nursing home may have a very hard time making ends meet. But we have decided as a country that we really don't care to support them with financial aid. Now, maybe that's the right choice. Maybe it's not. But the fact is that the family is going to struggle. They might even struggle to send their student to a public institution. But, I mean, the other thing is there are families who make $55,000 a year And they may be too rich, quote unquote, to get a federal Pell Grant, but they're certainly too poor to afford today's college prices.
So what's happening among colleges and universities that's pricing middle-class families out of higher education?
The number one thing that is happening in the public sector, which is where 3 in 4 students in this country go to college. And that is that the states have changed the deal they made with families. So in the past, for every tuition dollar that there was as an expense, the state covered the vast majority of that cost, leaving the family to cover only a minority of it. Now, on a per-student basis, states have pulled back. Wisconsin has been one of those states. So has Pennsylvania, where I live now. We're one of the worst in the entire country when it comes to affordability because the state simply is not putting in money to help offset the price for the students. As a result, colleges have to charge more tuition. Now, you could argue colleges should just learn how to offer less to these students and do it cheaper. That is a hard case to make at a time when we have opened our doors to more people coming to college who come from less advantaged backgrounds. So as more people come to college whose parents didn't go to college, they need more advising and more support and more tutoring. The country needs them to go to college because economically we know we're better off for it. But to ask a college to support that student the same way they supported a wealthy student of the past, that's not realistic.
Now, Sarah, some have said that we have to come to this realization that college isn't for everybody and that back in the day, a college education was seen for years as a ticket to the middle class. Is that true?
I actually think the realization we need to come to is that we as a country don't understand what college is. I think that too many people are saying that when they say the word college, they think philosophy degree, they think women's studies degree, they think graduate degree. They need to think HVAC technician. They need to think truck driver training. They need to think certified nursing assistant. You can't do those jobs without a certificate or an associate degree. College is the place where you get it. So if we want to have people who are not certified working to fix parts of our houses, if we want to have people who are not certified providing us medical care, then by all means tell people that we don't need college. But what we need to do is realize that even our universities are providing the very necessary training that is important for all sorts of jobs. We also need to recognize that this is not just about training. We also need to recognize that people are healthier, they live better lives, they are more effective at raising healthy and happy children when they've been able to spend time in the classroom learning how to negotiate and navigate this complicated world that we live in. They are more likely to vote. And so I think we know quite well what it means to tell people that not everyone should go to college. It means college is for my children, but not for yours.
So what are some actionable steps that can help bring down the cost of college for a majority of American students?
There are a bunch of different things we can do. And frankly, I do want to note that we're making progress. There are some Band-Aids even that have been put into place that are helpful. I really appreciated when Governor Scott Walker put an emergency aid program into place to support the technical colleges because we knew that that need was there. It was a step in the right direction. We can do things to lower the price of food. We can do things to make textbooks more affordable. We can do things to make campus housing more affordable. There are a bunch of pieces of federal legislation pending on all of those fronts. Of course, we can also restore the funding to public higher education so that families don't have to make these impossible choices about whether or not their children can go to college. Doing so, it has been shown, creates an enormous return on investment so that the taxpayers are not spending money that doesn't come back to them. It's actually cheaper for everybody in the long run, as those people will be less likely to need public support from public benefits, more likely to pay taxes, and more likely to be good contributing members of society.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University. She joined us today to talk about why college is becoming less affordable for middle-class families and why accessibility to higher education is important. Coming up, we'll hear about a proposal in the state legislature to make it easier to clear a person's criminal record. And as some supporters have said, improve public safety, give people second chances, and help Wisconsinites improve their lives. We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Connor. Coming up, gone are the days when we go on the internet. We no longer go home to our computers and get eager to log on. The internet is always with us, and now it's becoming more and more present in different products, from washers and dryers to home security. We talk with a guest who says this leaves big gaps in our online security. But first, a mix of Republicans, Democrats, and advocacy groups on both sides of the aisle are calling for changes to the state's expungement laws. Currently, a court can wipe out a person's criminal record depending on the type of crime, the age of the perpetrator, and other factors. Under this new proposal, expungement restrictions would be more relaxed. Supporters, including Republican State Senator Alberta Darling, say too many people charged with low-level nonviolent crimes are being punished long after paying their debt to society, and that sealing criminal records would help them find work and improve their lives.
We're not talking about major felonies, sex offenses, drunken driving. We're talking about misdemeanors and H&I felonies. We're talking about jobs. We're talking about building the workforce, and we're talking about giving people a second chance.
Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter. Laurel, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel, how does expungement work under current state law?
So right now, a judge can grant expungement at sentencing. So at that very first stages of the case, you know, when someone is being sentenced, that's when it's decided whether they're eligible for expungement or not, whether the judge is going to grant that to them. It's only specific crimes, as you outlined before, and only individuals who are under 25 years of age right now. So sort of limited to young folks who committed certain nonviolent crimes. It's aimed at making sure that they have an avenue to not have that on their criminal record in the future if they want to, you know, search for employment, do things like that without having to check that box on the employment application.
Why was this law set in place to begin with?
So this is something that I think a lot of advocacy organizations, and certainly one of the sponsors of the bill, Representative Evan Goyke, who's a Democrat from Milwaukee, have had their eyes on for quite a long time. They say it's just kind of out of date. I think the original, I can't speak exactly to the original intent of the bill in terms of who wrote it to begin with, this old legislation, but I can say it's been around for a while. It hasn't been changed. And supporters are saying that a number of states have updated their expungement laws to make them a little bit broader. And Wisconsin would be kind of following in their footsteps if this bill were to be passed.
What problems exist as a result of our expungement laws? I know you alluded mm-hmm. to some of them, but at least in the eyes of those who are calling for change.
Mm-hmm. So there were a number of advocacy organizations present at a press conference at the Capitol today saying that they support this legislation. One of those is an advocacy organization from Milwaukee that does a variety of criminal justice reform initiatives and support for individuals who have served their time and are integrating back into the community. And they say that even though there are state laws that prohibit discrimination against people that have criminal records who are seeking employment, they say it still happens. And so there's this barrier for individuals who have committed crimes but have served their time, haven't reoffended, and are looking for work. And these advocacy organizations believe that if there's an avenue by which they can remove that criminal record, you know, kind of have a fresh start, it's going to help them get jobs, be good employees, you know, have a steady paycheck, and that's going to be good not only for that individual, but society as a whole. You know, it would potentially reduce recidivism, which has certainly been an issue in Wisconsin. So they're saying it's not only kind of a case-by-case individual benefit here, but one that stretches really all across the state.
Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio state capitol reporter, and we're talking about a bipartisan proposal that would relax expungement restrictions. Now, a report from the Badger Institute a couple of years ago says that current laws don't work because judges have to decide on expungement at the time of sentencing rather than after the punishment is served. So according to the bill's supporters, That has been problematic. And how so?
Well, they say that it really should be something that's taken into account, how someone served their time, what their conduct was like, whether they have advanced in terms of, you know, getting training, getting treatment, rehabilitation, things like that. They say that how someone conducts themselves while they are serving their sentence should be something that is taken into account or part of the equation, perhaps. The fact that right now expungement is limited to that very first step, that sentencing, doesn't seem fair to some of these individuals. They say that it should be open to individuals at the end of the process as well who have done things that would merit their criminal record being cleared.
Now, you talked about some of the folks who are involved in pushing for reform, but who else is leading the charge on this?
So this is a bipartisan bill. I think we may have mentioned that.
Yes.
So we have a coalition of a Republican and a Democrat in the Senate, a Republican and a Democrat in the Assembly. In the Senate, it's one of the more powerful members of the Senate, actually Senator Alberta Darling, who's a co-chair of the State Budget Committee. So having her kind of high profile backing on this bill is something that is definitely worth remarking upon. And then we also see a kind of a bipartisan representation in the advocacy organizations that are backing this bill as well. There's support from Americans for Prosperity, which is a more conservative-leaning advocacy group. Some folks might be familiar with that. At the same time, the American Civil Liberties Union is backing this bill. So it is certainly an example of people crossing the aisle and organizations crossing the aisle in support of a change to state law.
It's always great to hear anything that has bipartisan support, especially nowadays. What about the rest of the state legislature? Do we know how much support there is for expungement reform?
We have a little bit of a hint. There was a very similar bill that was introduced during the last legislative session, and it passed the state assembly unanimously, a vote of 95-0, I believe. So it certainly had strong support. A similar bill had strong support then. It was never taken up in the state Senate, however, which obviously is an important part of the process. So we'll have to see. Lawmakers, the sponsors that were at the press conference today, said that they're pretty optimistic about this bill making it all the way through this time. They said that it was introduced kind of late in the legislative session last time around, so they think that contributed to it not really making it over the finish line. Sometimes it's logistical challenges like that that limit how far a bill can go. Just because of the volume of things that lawmakers are trying to take up, there kind of has to be a triage sometimes. So that's what they were pointing to in this instance. And I think they're hoping that getting the ball rolling a little bit earlier this time, earlier in the legislative session, is going to help this get over the finish line.
Has Governor Evers weighed in on this at any point?
Not that I'm aware of. We do know that this specific proposal anyway, we do know that the governor is very interested in criminal justice reform. He's interested in reducing the rates of incarceration in Wisconsin and investing more in rehabilitation and reintegration initiatives. So this would seem to be in the same vein as some of the things that the governor has said he supports, but we don't have a statement from him on this particular legislation just yet.
We have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you, is there any, do you have any idea of what expungement laws exist in other states?
Yeah, we do know that a number of other states have this more kind of open expungement policy. You know, Wisconsin limiting expungement to individuals that are under 25 is something I think that is unique. And was clearly aimed in the beginning at, you know, sort of targeting young people who have, you know, lives and careers ahead of them. But a number of other states have made moves to expand that age range. Also, we know that some states have been a little bit more lenient about the type of crime that qualifies. And we're not looking at broadening that in this legislation. That element would stay the same.
Laurel, thanks so much for joining us. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter, talking about a bipartisan proposal to make it easier to remove low-level crimes from someone's record. For the first time in school history, Marquette's men's and women's basketball teams are in the top 10. The Marquette men's team is number 9 in the USA Today coaches poll and number 10 in the AP poll. The Marquette women are number 10 in the AP poll, and the USA Today coaches poll comes out later today. Now, that combined with the Badger men's basketball team, who are in the top 25, and the fact that the Milwaukee Bucks have the best record in the Eastern Conference right now at this moment, and we're not quite at the All-Star break, but it's great to hear because it seems that Wisconsin is turning into a basketball mecca. This is really the first time, and for Marquette women's and men's basketball teams being in the top 10 at the same time is great news. But this is one of the best years of Wisconsin basketball that we've seen in a very, very long time. And could you imagine? Now, I know we're not at the All-Star break yet for the NBA, but can you imagine if the Bucks ended up with the Eastern Conference best record and they had home field advantage throughout the playoffs in a brand new arena? How exciting would that be? More at Central Time right here on the Ideas Network.